Lord with you. I often hear conservative and evangelical preachers lament like this. They would say, oh, today's spiritual atmosphere is getting worse and worse. And they would complain. They say, oh, the world and time that we live in is getting more and more ungodly. And they would say, we need to go back to the past. We need to go back to the past to find models of godliness. Now, I'm a conservative. I am evangelical. And I make no apology to say that. I trust in the Bible as God's word, just like conservative evangelical preacher would say. But I always wonder, when we hear teachings like that, do we right away accept those words without critical judgment? Teachings like that can be very misleading. Teachings like that can be very inaccurate. It is very true. There are models of godliness in the past that we can follow. But the thing is, we must not think that the best is in the past. There are models of godliness in the past that we can follow, but spiritual failures in the past were just as grievous as they are today. What we need to do is look at the failures, spiritual failures of the past, and use them as warnings for our lives today, so that we may learn to live in manners that pleases God. We return today to the lives of great prophets of Israel. We have become very familiar with Elijah. But our study of Elijah is finished. Elijah is gone. He has gone up to heaven in fiery horses and fiery chariots. Now the question is, who else is left to remind us of what God has to say to us? Who is to follow Elijah to give us spiritual warnings? The next few weeks, we are going to look into the work and life of Elisha. That's Elijah's successor. You know what the most difficult of all career? The most difficult of all profession? The most of all careers and profession is to be the successor of a great predecessor. That's the worst thing anybody can do. How do you follow the presidency of George Washington? Very few people remember John Adams. John Adams had a terrible time as the second president of the United States. How do you follow the presidency of Abraham Lincoln? Very few of us remember somebody by the name of Andrew Johnson. Andrew Johnson had a horrible time as Lincoln's successor. You remember Reverend Simon Choi? Oh, thank you. Very good. I count it an honor to have him as my dear friend. Our dear friend, Pastor Simon Choi, I'm sure Edward remembers. Love to repeat this story to us. You remember? He would tell us a story about First Baptist Church in Dallas. Now, First Baptist Church in Dallas is without question the flagship of Southern Baptist Convention. It is known not only as the largest Baptist church in the United States, it is also the largest Baptist church in the world. It doesn't have a very long history. It's only got a history of 140 years, not very long. But of those 140 years, two great pastors stood out above all else. Above who? The first one is called George Washington Truett, George W. Truett. He pastored the church, First Baptist Church of Dallas, from 1897 to 1944. And under his guidance, the church grew from a membership of 750 to a membership of 7,800. Now, that's a whopping 47 years and a tenfold growth. Now, how do you find a successor to follow that? Well, they found someone by the name of W.A. Criswell. Wally Amos Criswell. And how long did W.A. Criswell pastor there? From 1944 to 1997. That's a whopping 53 years. And the membership grew from 7,800 to 26,000. And Pastor Simon Choi is fond of telling me that and telling Edward too. He would say, in 100 years, of the history of First Baptist Church of Dallas, they only had two pastors. And not just any two pastors. In those 100 years, the church grew to occupy six city blocks in Dallas. Six blocks. It has a youth family life center. And in it, they have a bowling alley. They have a skating rink. And they have a gymnasium that's got indoor running track and basketball courts. And the church has ministry to the hearing impaired. They have a training union. That's a Baptist way of saying training program. They have vacation Bible school and summer camps. They have 37 inner-city missions. They have a crisis pregnancy center. They have ministry to the homeless and the disadvantaged. They have Spanish chapel. Of course, they have Chinese missions. And some of our dear friends came from the Chinese mission in First Baptist. You remember Dr. Stewart, the Wu, and Fanny Wu, our dear, dear friends. Some of us know them. They have spent time in the Chinese mission in First Baptist in Dallas. They have TV and radio ministry. In 100 years, they have two pastors like Truett and Criswell. How do you follow the footsteps of these two giant pastors? How? With great difficulty. From 1997 to today is only 14 years. They have had four pastors. And that's an average of 3.5 years per each pastor. It is hard to follow spiritual giants. And it is no different with Elisha. How do you follow a prophet like Elijah? When your predecessor had been to the highest summit of spiritual victory, where do you go from there? When you have taken your people to the pinnacle of Mount Everest, where do you go from there? With man, that is impossible. But with God, nothing is impossible. With man, it is impossible to follow the footsteps of giants like Elijah. But with God, God still has plenty of work and words for Elisha to say and to do in front of God's people. And all Elisha had to do is fix his eyes on God. All Elisha had to do is fix his heart on obedience. And Elisha still had plenty of work and word to speak to God's people. Elisha is like Elijah in a number of ways. First of all, Elisha is the prophet who preached not only with words, but he preached with the work of his hands. He does more with what he does than with what he says. Elijah's words were not written down in books like Isaiah or Jeremiah, but his word was spoken just as loud and just as clear with his work of his hand. And the first word Elisha had to speak to Israel and to us is this word, promise. Promise. And the first challenge Elisha has to give to us is, are we committed to our promises? We don't take the word promise too seriously today, do we? We go to the wedding altar. We promise to keep each other in marriage to death. Till death do us part, in sickness and in health, for richer and poorer. But we don't take that promise too seriously anymore. We don't even like to use those words in those vows. You know, they write their own vows now. They talk about the birds and talk about the bees and talk about the flowers and they talk about, oh, how beautiful it is. But they don't want to say those words of promises anymore. And even if they do, they're only paying lip service to those words. And those vows are only going through the motion. 1 month after the honeymoon, and they realize that, well, reality isn't as beautiful as the flowers and the butterflies. And they forget those promises. And 1 month after that, they started contemplating about calling their lawyers. We promise our children, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. But then we got busy. And we conveniently forget what we promise. Politicians promise us this and promise us that so that they can get elected. And as soon as they get elected, all those promises mean nothing anymore, and they are broken. And we accept that. You remember an old anchorman in CBS News, Walter Cronkite? This is what he said at the end of every broadcast. And that's just the way it is. And we accept that. What about our commitment to each other? What about our commitment to our fellowship group? What about our commitment to each other as a congregation that we belong to, as a spiritual home that we belong to? What about our commitment that we have made to our God? That is Elisha's first message to us, to Israel as a people belonging to God and to us as a people belonging to God. Do we take our commitment to God seriously? Do we take our promises that we have made to God seriously? You see, in Bible language, the word commitment to God is the word covenant. In Bible language, the word commitment, promise to God, is the word covenant. God's commitment to his people never fail. God never failed to keep his promise to us as his covenant that he has made to us. But can we say the same for the people of God, Israel? Can we say the same about us? Has Israel been unfailing in their covenantal commitment to God? Has Israel been unfailing in their covenantal promise to God? That's the whole reason why God had to send prophets to Israel. That's the whole reason why God is starting to send Elijah and Elisha. Because Israel had failed miserably in their keeping of the covenantal commitment and promise. Israel had promised they will go after no other God but to Yahweh. Israel had promised, quickly, we will worship no other God but Yahweh. We will serve no one else, no other God but Yahweh. But to Israel, those were all empty promises. They quickly forgot what Yahweh has done for them. They quickly forgot God's promise of blessing if they would remain faithful. They quickly forgot that God promised them curses if they would insist on disobedience. They quickly forgot the promise of loyalty they had made. Israel had set up altars to Baal, to Asherah, all over Israel. And God had to send Elijah to them to remind them of the promises that they had made, the promises of loyalty and faithfulness they had made to Yahweh. And Elijah had to physically do battle against Ahab and against Jezebel, the ringleader of Israel's apostasy. God had to send Elijah to them to personally do battles against 850 false prophets of Baal and Asherah. Elijah had to violently order the executions of these false prophets and Baal. You know, critics of the Bible would say, oh, that's too violent. That's too bloody. You know what? It is true. It is violent. It is drastic. It is bloody. But the life and health of Israel was at stake. And critical situations demand drastic action. Now the work of Elijah is done. Okay? But the work remained unfinished. Elijah had to continue the work of calling Israel back to God. Elisha may not be as fiery and violent as Elijah, but the urgency is the same. The reminder to Israel of their covenantal commitment, that urgency is the same. The call to Israel to keep their covenantal promise to God, return to God, that urgency is the same. That's the message of the passage that we read earlier. Turn with me, please, back to 2 Kings chapter 2. On the surface, these incidents seem very trivial, very minor. We only read two little stories, but for time, I didn't read the first incident. Three little stories, three little miracles. But underneath what seems so trivial and minor is a loud and clear trumpet call to Israel. Remember the promises that you have made to God. Remember the commitment that you once made to God. Look at verses 19 to 22 first. We didn't read this. We're going to go over this too. Just a little story. Elijah had gone to heaven. Now the ministry is resting squarely on the shoulder of Elisha. But he was not alone. Elijah had company of prophets with him, and they're from Jericho. And these company of prophets from Jericho recognized God's seal of approval was on Elisha. They recognized commission of God was on Elisha, because look at verse 15. Now, we didn't read this earlier. We read this together. Now, shall we please? From the company of the prophets, shall we please, together? The company of the prophets from Jericho who were watching said, "The spirit of Elijah is resting on Elisha." We stopped there. Now, that was very necessary for Elisha to receive, because his credential as God's prophet, his credential as Elijah's successor, was recognized and accepted. That's important. That's necessary. Credential was recognized and accepted. But the problem is, what about the confidence that he needed? Is the company of prophets really ready to follow Elisha's leadership? That is why following spiritual giants is the most difficult, the most demanding of all God's servants. See, the company of prophets, they recognize Elijah's credential, but they were still not yet ready to follow his leadership. Because look at verse 16. "Look," they said, "we, your servants, have 50 able men here. Let them go and look for your master. Perhaps the Spirit of the Lord had picked him up and set him down on some mountain or in some valley." You see what's happening? They recognize Elisha as having the credential to be prophets, but they were still looking for Elijah, even though he was gone. They were not ready to follow anybody else. They were still looking for Elijah. They are still saying to Elijah, sure, you've gone to seminary. Sure, you have had so many seminary degrees. But our pastor is still Elijah. Now, what is Elijah going to say to that? What can he say? The only thing Elijah can say is the truth. Elijah can only say, "No, don't go. You won't find him. He is gone." Because look at verse 16. "No," Elijah replied, "do not send them." Now, do you think the company of prophet is going to listen to that? You think they are going to be ready to accept leadership of Elisha? No, they were not. Look at verse 17. "But they persisted until Elisha was too ashamed to refuse." Too ashamed, too embarrassed to refuse. Because what can Elisha do? 50 men say, "We are not ready to follow you." 50 men saying, "We are still following the one who had just retired." Now, what can Elisha say about that? No, follow me now. I'm the new boss. How can he say that? Anyone would have been embarrassed to insist on that. So that is why we read in verse 17. "So he said," Elisha said to them, "okay, send them." And they sent 50 men who searched for 3 days but did not find him. Look at verse 18. "When they returned to Elisha, who was staying in Jericho, he said to them, 'Didn't I tell you not to go? Didn't I tell you not to go? You guys just don't listen, do you?'" To establish leadership after the footstep of spiritual giants is the most difficult, because everyone is still looking for that spiritual giant who has moved on. And the company of prophets were saying this to Elisha, "Yeah, you may have the credential of a prophet. Yes, you may be wearing Elijah's mantle, but you don't look anything like Elijah." But Elijah had to say to them, "You're not going to find Elijah anymore, because all you got now is me." Elisha had to establish his ministry, and God's hand was on him. Elisha had crossed to the west bank of Jordan. You remember Joshua? At the beginning of the conquest, he had gone on exactly the same route. They crossed over the Jordan onto the west bank of Jordan, and Jericho was the first city they encountered. And the men of Jericho came out and talked to Elisha like this. Right? They said, "Well, we are well protected in this city, but we got a problem. We don't have water that is good. Look at verse 19. The water is bad and the land is unproductive. I don't know why it's bad. Maybe it was too alkaline. Maybe it's just too basic. In chemistry, it's called too basic. Whatever the poison is, no human and no animal can drink from it, and no vegetation can grow because of this poison. And Elisha said, bring me a new bowl. Put some salt in it. Then he went out to the spring, and he put the salt into the spring. And he proclaimed on behalf of God. Look at verse 21. I have healed this water. Never again will it cause death or make the land unproductive. And the result of Elisha's word, look at verse 22. And the water remained wholesome to this day, according to the word Elisha has spoken. You see, on the surface, it's just a little simple miracle, isn't it? Turning poisonous water into good water, sweet and fitting for human consumption, fit for the watering crops. But is that all? No. There's a far deeper meaning for Israel. Because it is an object lesson from God through Elisha to the people of Israel. And the message is this. You see the water is poisonous, God is saying. Yes, they are bad. Because it is a curse of the covenant that you have made to me and that you have violated. God is saying, I have brought you out of bondage in Egypt. I have brought you into this land of promise. I have brought you to myself. I have made you a people belonging to me. I have made you to be a people treasured by me. You are a treasured possession to me. And the promise I made to you is this. Blessing of health, blessing of life is yours to enjoy if you will be faithful and commitment to me. But since you have rejected me as your God, since you have turned away from me and whore after Baal and Asherah, and just as I promised in my covenantal agreement, curses will be upon you. You will be deprived of life-giving water. You will be deprived of good drinking water, and the land will not bear fruit for you. The land will not bear crop for you. But I am a God slow to anger. I am a God abounding in love. I am a God who delight in forgiveness. I will forgive you if you will return to me. And just to show you what I will do, I'm sending you my servant Elisha, and he's going to demonstrate to you my healing and my forgiveness. And my blessing will be poured out to you again, just as Elisha poured a new bowl and poured out my blessing on you. It is not the salt that heals. If I remember my chemistry right, if you put salt in a basic solution, it's not going to make it neutral. Perhaps it's just the opposite. The salt will make the water even more unusable and unconsumable. The point is this. It is not the salt that heals. It is I, the Lord, your God, who heal. I will turn this poisonous water into healing and into life. The point is made. God is slow to anger and abounding in love. God delights in forgiveness. God always has his arm extended out to you, Israel. If you will return to me from your disobedience, and if you will return to me, I will bring life and healing to you. Is Israel going to listen to that? We find the answer in the next incident. From healing the poisonous water in Jericho, Elisha went on to Bethel. Now, this is a passage that we read earlier, verses 23 to 25. Is Israel going to listen to the word of Elisha, calling people to return to God? He was traveling on his way to Bethel, and some youth, I don't know, teenagers, junior highers, I don't know, came out and insulted and jeered Elisha. Go on up, you bald head. Go on up. Go on, you bald head. Look at verse 24. Let's read that together. Verse 24. Shall we please? Elisha turned around, looked at them, and called down a curse on them in the name of the Lord. Then two bears came out of the woods and mauled 42 of the youth. You know how to solve youth problem? That's a quick and easy way. What do we make of this? I mean, on the surface, this guy Elisha really got a problem, doesn't he? I mean, he's got an anger management problem. I mean, he's a man of short temper. He's a man with a huge ego. He can't even stand a little tease. I mean, how can a man like that be in the ministry? I remember some of those older, you remember Pastor Yim from Chinatown Church. I look up to him with great respect. I wish I had studied ministry with him. I remember one thing Pastor Yim of Chinatown said to me long, long ago. He said, Ben, as a minister, you can never show your anger in front of people. I hope I learned that well. I don't know. Elisha violated that principle rule as a man of ministry. He was quick to anger. He can't even take a little tease. I mean, after all, teenagers are teenagers. Junior, sixth graders, seventh graders. What do you expect from junior hiders, right? But we fail to see the spiritual truth beneath the surface. On the surface, we have a rookie minister. I mean, he's green. He's still wet behind the ears. He couldn't control his anger. He couldn't even take a little tease, a little marking. But in reality, what these teenagers, what these junior hiders were doing was not just marking a prophet. What they were doing was marking the God who has sent the prophet. See, whether these teenagers recognize Elisha as a man of God is not the point. If they had marked Elisha out of ignorance, then their guilt would extend to their parents because their parents had failed to train the teenager up in the knowledge of the Lord. In Israel culture, a man having a full head of hair is a symbol of his strength, is a symbol of honor, is a symbol of power. And Elisha obviously did not have the outward appearance of strength, did not have the outward appearance of honor and power. But Elisha was God's anointed. Elisha was sent as God's spokesman. He was sent to proclaim God's message of repentance. He was sent to call an idolatrous Israel to return to God, reminding Israel to keep their covenantal agreement and commitment to God, and to mark Elisha of his lack of strength, to tease him, to insult him of his lack of power and of honor, is the same as insulting and marking God of impotence in the face of Baal. See, this Israel were representing Israel. These young teenagers were representing Israel as a whole. Israel is saying, your God, Yahweh, he is bald-headed just as you are. He has no power. He has no strength. He has no honor. We don't worship him. We worship Baal instead. And when they insult God like that, when Israel insult God like that, and we expect God to turn a blind eye to that kind of offense, a group of insolent teenagers did that, representing an insolent Israel doing that to God. And we expect them to get away with that. Do you remember? Elijah had at least 450 prophets of Baal executed. Elisha had only 42 of these teenagers killed. Bloody? Yes. But when you mock Elisha, when you insult his impotence, when you insult God, Elisha's honor was God's honor. Elisha's strength and power was God's strength and power. 42, God was very lenient in what he did. Mauled by bears is a curse. Absolutely. Because God is using that as a reminder of his promise of curses when commitment to God is broken. When the promise that we made to God of faithfulness and loyalty is broken, It's no child play. It's no teasing from teenagers. Turn with me to 2 Kings chapter 4. The passage that we read earlier, verses 1 to 7. Again, just another little story, another little miracle. On the surface, minor and trivial. We've seen it before. Elijah did that before with the oil and bread. Remember the flour? Elisha is doing the same. One of the prophets died, and he left behind his widow and two sons. But what he left behind was more than a family of three. He left behind a debt that his widow cannot pay back. Now, in our days, if we owe a debt that we cannot repay, the worst thing that can happen to us, maybe the bank would repossess the house or the lender repossess our car. And all they have to do is just liquidate all our assets and pay off debts. And if every bit of asset is sold and there's still outstanding balance in our debt, well, the creditors is out of luck. That's all they can do. They cannot touch the debtor physically. They cannot touch the children of the debtor physically. But in biblical times, creditors can sell the debtor into slavery. Or he can sell the children of the debtor into slavery to recover the debt that he owed. And that is a crisis the widow is facing in chapter 4. In her desperation, she cried out to Elisha for help. But what can Elisha do? Elijah has no money. So Elijah asked the widow, how can I help you? What can I do for you? What do you have? The widow said, I have a little oil. Elijah said, that's it. That's enough. That is going to be your salvation. Then Elisha said to her, go home, look for all the empty jars that you can find. And when you cannot find any more, go to your neighbors and ask for more. Look at this phrase. Don't ask for a few. Ask as many as you can get. Ask for big things. Go get all the empty jars you can find, and whatever little oil that you have in your house, pour it into all the empty jars. And she did that as she was told. She poured whatever little oil that she had, and the miracle of the oil was it never stopped flowing. All the empty jars that she had collected or borrowed were filled. The oil stopped only when there's no more empty jars. Then she came to Elisha and told him. Elisha said, now you go sell the oil. Plenty of proceeds to cover all your debts. And then you're going to have all the leftover. That is for you and your two sons to live on. Just a little story. Just a little miracle story, right? No. Again, God's message through the hand of Elisha is the same. God is repeating and reiterating the same point. When you obey me, when you keep your covenant agreement with me, I will not stop blessing you. That's the point God is saying to Israel. I will pour out my blessing on you and on your family. There will be an outflowing, outpouring of my grace and mercy on you. So much so that you're going to have leftover. Your cup runs over. All the jar that you can find, no matter what size, cannot hold all my grace and blessing and mercy. There are a few phases in these few seven verses. Verse 1, this is how the faithfulness of this family is recorded. Look at verse 1. And you know that he revered the Lord. This is a widow saying to Elisha about his deceased husband. You know how he lived. He lived faithfully before God. He revered the Lord, even in such a time of apostasy, when nobody knows the Lord, when everybody turned away, but there's still a little remnant of people who will remain faithful, who will revere the Lord. And God will keep his covenantal promise to all those who revere him. And then there's a second phase that we need to look at, verse 3. Elisha said, don't ask for a few. What's Elisha telling her? Is Elisha telling her to be greedy? No. It's not an expression of greed. It is an expression of faith. Do we trust God enough that he will pour out his blessing on us overabundantly? Elisha is challenging the widow, do you trust in God enough that God will keep his promise to you? Don't ask for a few. No matter how many jars you have collected, no matter what size the capacity, God will always overflow his blessing. This relationship between God and man never changes. The covenantal promise God made to us never changes. It is so in the Old Testament, the Old Covenant. It is the same in the New Covenant, in the New Testament. When we obey God and we will walk in His way, blessing will always come. When we disobey Him, when we turn away from Him, curses will always come. God will always keep His commitment to us. And the question is, do we always keep our commitment to Him? The Christian life is a very simple life. It's not our ability to understand the most profound of theology that determines blessings or success in Christian life. It is not how much you understand the Bible. It is not how much you can solve the problem of evil or problem of pain. It is not how articulate you are in answering the dilemma or the difficult question of predestination. It is not how profound a theology you know. It is how faithful you and I are in keeping our covenantal commitment to God that determines how blessed we are. It is how we commit ourselves to God's word, to God's church, that determines how blessed we are. You see, we are people not belonging to ourselves anymore. The problem is, people live the way, this is my life. I'm going to live it any way I want. No one can tell me what to do. God cannot tell me. The Bible can tell me. You preacher cannot tell me. This is my life. I'll live it the way I am. But the problem is, this is not our life. Whose life is this? This is a life belonging to God. God paid a dear price for our life. It belongs to Him. God says, I will keep my promise to you. Won't you do the same with me? Walk with Him faithfully, closely, as we continue to grow in our faith. Blessing, not just a little, don't ask for a little, will be outpoured to us overflowingly, most abundantly. Let's all stand. We're going to sing a response hymn together. I am thine, O Lord. I have heard your voice, and it told your love to me. And I long to rise in the arms of faith, to be closer drawn to you. Let's sing this together.